You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS
and Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, January 24th, 2013. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, to react to the exit or imminent exit of the DOJ's Lanny Breuer, he who did not prosecute anyone from Wall Street in the financial crisis. Elliot Spitzer will be with us. Also fresh off his appearance in that film which led to Lanny Breuer's exit, or is speculated to have, The Untouchables, on Frontline the other night. Also on the program today, congratulations, ladies. You can now die in combat in all branches of the military. Also on the program today, when is a fetus not a person in the eyes of Catholicism? Well, apparently when their hospital may be on the hook for a malpractice suit or a wrongful death suit. Also on the program today, revealed President Obama. His fealty to the Constitution is a problem for Republicans, but not the American Constitution, the Soviet Constitution. Fresh off the heels of the Sierra Club making an announcement that for the first time they were going to allow for a one-off civil action protest, even in Utah, Republicans now concede global warming may be a bit of a problem. Unions, membership down, according to the latest Bureau of Labor Statistics study. Shell Bachman, the hits keep coming. You've got to pay those former campaign workers, even if they don't sign a non-disclosure, is the lesson. We will get to that and more in just a moment. Unemployment claims. New claims for unemployment benefits fell 5,000 in the last week. The seasonally adjusted number was 330,000, down from 335 in the previous week. Better than a poke in the eye, I guess. Still nowhere where we need to be. And on the just give you an update on what is being discussed by our government in terms of helping those job numbers. It is nothing. No discussion whatsoever of jobs. Of course, because we have a debt crisis, don't you know? Though we can borrow money at historically low rates, and people are continuing to loan us money some fashion or another, we have a debt crisis, even though the deficit is shrinking at the fastest pace it has in almost 60 years. We apparently have a debt crisis. even though the $1.2 trillion cuts on the books already would lead to complete diminishment of the deficit within a number of years, we have a debt crisis, apparently. Well, we'll see. I guess the only answer is to cut Social Security or Medicare. But to do it far enough in the future so that the decision cannot be tied to the execution of that decision. Announced yesterday by Defense Secretary Leon Panetta, the Pentagon has removed the military's ban on women serving in combat. There were very few combat positions available to women prior to this decision. One, of course, was to fly helicopters. Tammy Duckworth, U.S. Congresswoman from, I believe it's Wisconsin, am I right? Illinois. She fought in Iraq with the Illinois Army National Guard and lost both her legs when an RPG essentially hit her helicopter back in 2004. She's one of the most, I guess, sort of prominent female vets wounded in combat. Now, congratulations, ladies. You will all have the opportunity to die in a series of wars that this country will wage. Nothing specific in the future that we're planning. Maybe you can head over to Afghanistan and die in combat there. But surely we will come up with more wars to wage for resources or just basically to generate funds for people who are in the business of making money off of war. And I know it's got to be a little bit disappointing at a time when so much of our war is being fought by robots in the sky, won't give you the opportunity that you would have just even 10, 15 short years ago. But yes, I guess it's about time. I don't know if this is I don't know if I would label this as a huge feminist win per se, but it is. It's going to give women the opportunity at least to move up in the ranks of a massive institution in this country, one which I would hope would be smaller in the future. But be that as it may, it's about time. And now I hope the next step is to then get rid of the military. Highly unlikely. All right, we've got to take a break. When we come back, we will talk to, I spoke to Elliot Spitzer earlier this morning to get his reaction on Lanny Breuer's exit. Remember, Lanny Breuer was the guy who said, quite famously now a couple months ago, the reason why the Department of Justice cannot pursue criminal action against leaders of HSBC, the bank that was found to have laundered literally, what was it? Billions upon billions of dollars. Almost, what was it, $10 billion over the course of 15 years? They don't know exactly how much, but it's pretty close to that. For Mexican drug cartels, was really focused on this film that we have a link to on the majority.fm page. This Frontline hour-long documentary about the lack of criminal prosecutions, and I would argue the lack of criminal investigations of the fraud perpetrated that led to the financial meltdown in this country. Lanny Breuer has now, it's been leaked that he's leaving. It was only weeks ago the Washington Post had said that he would probably leave at the end of 2013. Now it appears he'll be exiting a little bit quicker. And I can't recommend this documentary enough. I hadn't seen it until last night, but it really it really makes it quite explicit as to what happened. We've spoken in the past to at least a couple of people who were featured in that film, including Elliot Spitzer, who we will speak to in a moment, and Jeff Connaughton, who was the number one aide, I guess, to Senator Ted Saunders, is that what it was?
Ted Kaufman. Chief of staff.
Chief of staff to Ted Kaufman, who filled in for Joe Biden just for 2 years. And, boy, it would have been nice for him to be in there for four.
Well, that was why he was so good, right?
Yes.
It was only going to be a couple of years.
Well, he wasn't going to run for re-election, but if he had been in for four, who knows what would have happened. All right, well, we got to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Elliot Spitzer. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome back to the program Elliot Spitzer, who I actually saw last night in the film The Untouchables, How the Obama Administration Protected Wall Street from Prosecutions on PBS. We have a link to that film. You can watch it online. Welcome back to the program, Elliot.
Sam, always great to be chatting with you. Thank you for inviting me.
So I'm not sure when you you sat down with the makers of that film, but it really focused specifically on the failure of the Obama administration to pursue any criminal charges against the top executives involved in the financial crisis, specifically the tremendous amount of, well, I, you know, based upon the film, we're not supposed to say the word fraud, but the fraud that took place in the securitization of these mortgage products.
Right. And
of course, today or last night, I guess, shortly following the airing of the film, Lanny Breuer, or it was leaked that he is planning to leave the Obama administration. We don't have a timetable for this yet, but.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, you've seen the film. Just give me your sense. I mean, did the film properly go after? I mean, Lanny Breuer was the focus of this film in many respects. He was the head of the criminal division. Just give me your sense on how accurate you felt the film was, and if it was really getting the nub of what the problem was here.
I think it was a stupendous piece of television. And as I was sitting there watching it and sitting there with my wife, and we had our kids and a few of their friends there, I said, watch this. You can take many important lessons from this. I think that film, what was on PBS Frontline last night, as well as Inside Job, Charles Ferguson's brilliant movie about the entirety of the cataclysm, capture both the range of the conspiracy and the lack of prosecutorial response. And, you know, watching the Frontline piece, there's no question Ted Kaufman was the hero and Lanny Breuer was the villain. You know, Lanny Breuer, the prosecutor who should have done much more and yet who was always hemming, hawing, hedging, articulating reasons not to act rather than to act. Now, you know, I've been a prosecutor. I've made tough decisions, and people will agree with some, disagree with some. So I hate to sort of paint with too broad a brush, but Lanny Breuer did not demonstrate the backbone over the past couple of years and the willingness to bring the charges, civil or criminal, against the entities that laid out the entirety of the massive fraud that was committed. And you're right, people are hesitant to use the word sometimes, but it was fraud. You read the stories and you say, yes, this was fraud. They knowingly marketed products that were bad. Much more should have been done.
What really struck me, and where I think that you can provide a tremendous amount of insight here, is that it is one thing, it seems to me, and Lanny Breuer, time and time again, whether he was talking to the filmmaker, whether he was talking to former Senator Ted Kaufman, who filled in for 2 years for Joe Biden, essentially, and seemed to be the only, well, not maybe not the only, but certainly the most fervent pursuer of criminal investigations of what took place. What seemed to really, what really struck me was that Leigh Brewer was making the argument that we don't have enough. We don't have enough to bring charges. But what was clear from that film, more so than I think laid out in any way, that there was no investigation. I mean, there that's exactly what really was done.
What they needed to do, and in the documentary, there was reference over and over again to the Clayton documents. Clayton was the company that did due diligence for the banks. Clayton reported back to the banks that the loans that they were making were bad. The question, and I said this in the documentary, I said, the question then became, what did the banks do with that information? If they were told by their own due diligence company, these loans are bad and you're still securitizing them, and people up the chain knew that, did not react to it, they're committing fraud, or they're negligent. There are multiple layers of many legal theories that could be used at that point to say what you did was wrong, stop it. And it does not appear that the Justice Department ever tried to track that information. It is slow. It's hard work. It's laborious. As I said in the film, you start at the bottom and work your way up. You follow the information trail. It doesn't seem that that was done. And as a consequence, senior executives and executives halfway up the chain were permitted to simply shrug their shoulders and say, oops, we made a mistake. And that's not the way the system should have worked.
From your perspective, as someone who was a chief prosecutor, not on a federal level, obviously on a state level, but do you make that determination as to whether or not you're going to seek an indictment, whether or not you're going to bring any type of charges prior to actually doing the investigation? I mean, that's what really stuck with me, was that there was no attempt. I mean, we saw in that film, you know, half a dozen whistleblowers there. Now, of course, Bowden, who was who was basically the internal mechanism at Citigroup for determining the value of those loans, and he was sending messages up the chain of command and getting no response. But there did not seem to be even investigations to bring you to the point of saying whether or not we could prove this beyond a reasonable doubt. That's what I found so shocking, is that,
well,
you can make that argument, right? Good.
We don't know with certainty the scope of their investigations, but I share your frustration. And I think what happened time and time again was that those who did the investigation, you had Ted Kaufman referring facts over to the Justice Department. You had Senator Levin referring facts over to the Justice Department. You had Phil Angelides, who produced the FCIC, the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission document, which is a stupendous piece of work, referring facts over to the Justice Department. Then time and time again, Justice would then kind of wring its hands and say, oh, well, gee, we don't think we can make the case. And that is what has led to this enormous frustration that you're articulating, that I've articulated. Prosecutors whom I trust have said, yes, we are of the same view. You know, it appears that and then Lanny would always be quoted saying, well, we have to consider the collateral consequences. What would happen if we bring a case against a big bank and there'd be shareholders who are innocent who are hurt? Well, that's true, but wait a minute. He's now beginning to get into such murky territory. He's excusing the failure to ever bring a case. It's the too big to fail, too big to manage, too big to indict type of world that we're now living in, which doesn't bode well for the stability of our financial system.
And what's stunning is that he made those comments that you're referring to, not in relation to the financial crisis per se, but into the case of HSBC, which was found to have been laundering literally billions of dollars of drug money. I mean, so
the failure to indict HSBC or senior individuals at HSBC about that money laundering is a horrendous, horrendous error on the Justice Department's part. They've been excoriated in editorials across the board. New York Times in particular really took them to task for this. And money laundering, again, if you're that big, suddenly you can launder hundreds of millions, billions of dollars of drug money and nobody is held accountable. You pay a little bit of a fine and then you move on. It is sending the wrong message, and it is, unfortunately, seems to be symptomatic of what Lanny was up to. Again, look, Lanny, decent guy. I've known him for many years. I don't want to sort of attack him at a personal level, but boy, his judgments are certainly not ones that I think comport with what judgments coming out of the Justice Department should have been. This is the Justice Department that was spending who knows how much FBI time, energy, money prosecuting Roger Clemens. right? And yet they couldn't find a case to be brought against Wall Street.
Right. I mean, not to mention people like Aaron Swartz, not to mention mm-hmm. whether you're talking about IP, whether you're talking about whistleblowers, on and on and on.
Exactly.
But now, one of the things that struck me in the film is that a short clip of Attorney General Holder, his name seemed to never come up. And
mm-hmm.
Give me your sense of what the likelihood is that Lanny Breuer had the ability essentially to stifle these investigations or to slow walk them or to not even engage in them, distinct from what his boss, Attorney General Holder, would have had anything to say in that regard.
You know, I can't speak to the dynamic between Lanny and Attorney General Holder. I know that when I was Attorney General in the state of New York and I had individuals who were the heads of the major divisions, any decision relating to a major case like that would be brought to me and we would discuss it and we would make a decision. I guess ultimately I would make the decision as Attorney General. And so I'm hard-pressed to believe that Attorney General Holder doesn't weigh in on significant determinations of this order of magnitude. He should. That is what the Attorney General is supposed to do, exercise management and also decision-making authority with respect to major structural decisions within the office, and these are those decisions. And so, again, we don't know. We don't know what Lanny and Eric spoke about, but I'm hard-pressed to believe that Eric Holder wasn't involved in many of these decisions.
Do you think that it would have been, I mean, you know, again, this is the area of speculation, and obviously you're not there, but, I mean, is this something that that would have started, do you think, with just a general policy of, like, we can't do this, versus Lanny Breuer taking up, you know, I mean, you know, again, from what we saw in that film and even from what he seemed to attest to, there was no Lanny Breuer made a very poor argument that he had done any type of due diligence as to whether or not there was enough proof here to bring those cases. I mean, he was asked point blank, how come you didn't talk to any of these whistleblowers? And he basically said, I'm sure that we must have. Which seemed to be pretty weak sauce, frankly.
Well, it's also shocking to me that after being asked the question, he didn't have his folks at the department go back and validate, verify whether they did or didn't, and then get back to the producers of the movie and saying, here we did. On date X, we spoke to so-and-so. In other words, we did our due diligence. So they left it hanging out there with uncertainty, which is not good. I've said this repeatedly in the past. Whistleblowers are the critical link in making these cases. You need the inside voices. You rarely find those best inside voices by simply picking up the phone and cold calling into the bank saying, gee, tell us what's going on that's ugly and criminal. Somebody will bring it to you. You need to handle those whistleblowers with very carefully. You need to nurture them. That's how the mutual fund cases led to tens of billions of dollars going back to consumers and changed that industry, all began with one whistleblower who walked into my office and said, here's what's going on. And that's how you make these cases.
And you know, I think sort of carrying on the theme of the film, one of the things that became clear is that in the absence, or maybe not necessarily because of the absence of any type of federal prosecutions, we've seen a growing number of civil cases being brought by essentially the clients who were duped out of buying these crappy packages of securitized mortgages. The latest, Jesse Eisender at ProPublica has a story about this large suit against Morgan Stanley, which seems to be sort of the perfect example of what we were watching in that film.
Exactly right. And it's also a replay of what Goldman had done a couple of years ago in the Abacus cases, where they take bad debt, dump it into a CDO, and then market it without telling the purchasers that somehow a determination has been made that this debt is not good. And withholding that information is not the way the market's supposed to work. Betting against the very product you're marketing is not good business practices. And the other thing that bothers me about the Justice Department is they've never sought remedies that will fix the problem. simply having a big company pay a fine doesn't do anything. What you need to do is have them change the way they're doing business. And that is within the ambit of a good prosecutor, within the ambit of the court. That is the creativity that they need to use and exercise, and they haven't done it.
And isn't the issue of the fact that they were betting against these tranches of securities? Isn't the point that that is sort of prima facie evidence that they knew these things were bad? I mean, that's the point, right? I mean, because they
it is again, it goes to the heart of the conflict that exists within too many of these entities. Where you're correct, they know they're marketing bad stuff, and they're taking a short position, not simply to hedge as they would have us believe, but because they believe they're fundamentally bad. And when you market something and you're shorting it, it goes back to the same sorts of duplicity that underlay what I call the analyst cases that we made back in 2002, which restructured all of Wall Street's analytical work, where they were selling stocks to the public knowing they were not good because they were getting the fees on the underwriting. I mean, that's the same sort of stuff that was going on here.
And in terms of a bank that knowingly issues these bad loans, and not just the services, but the we heard from Bowden in the film that at Citigroup he was looking at like a 60% failure rate on these loans,
right.
And he said this completely is in contradiction to our own stated policies about what constitutes a good loan. Are there criminal liabilities for banks? I mean, because presumably these loan issuing standards are not simply just, a business practice as much as it is also because they're federally insured in some instances, because the federal government functions as a backstop. Are there criminal or civil? I mean, I presume there are civil liabilities. Are there criminal liabilities if they knowingly break their own policies?
Absolutely. I mean, because the policy, what they'd be doing would be misrepresenting to the public. And the moment you make a false statement like that, you have all sorts of possibilities in terms of remedies and liability. But again, this goes back to your fundamental point, which is that Lanny certainly didn't give us the sense that the investigations had been done and the creative thinking had been brought to bear to figure out what could be done to stop either sanction what had happened or stop it prospectively. And that is what justice is supposed to do, and that's why I think there is the sense of outrage that permeated the documentary.
There's two other things I wanted to talk to you about. There was a story that came out the other day. It didn't get much play, but that a member of the Federal Reserve, I think coming out of, maybe it was out of St. Louis, has basically charged, or it was Richmond Fed, it was Jeffrey Lacker, about 5 years ago, I guess, or it was in August 2007, he had an exchange, and we don't find out what the Fed minutes don't get released for 5 years. He had an exchange with then head of the New York Fed, Tim Geithner, as to what the banks knew as to the Fed's plans to cut rates. Are you familiar with this story?
I saw it, and I saw the interchange as reported, and the disagreement between somebody who was at the meeting, and then what Tim Geithner said about his own statements and conversations with the bank chair. I think it was Ken Lewis at B of A. Obviously, Tim Geithner, who was then the president of the New York Fed, should not have been disclosing to anybody what was going to happen with discount rates or any other interest rate.
That's basically front running, right?
If it was being signaled, then that would be a problem.
That's basically front running, isn't it? I mean, this is the stuff.
Well, it would certainly give the bank the opportunity to adjust 1,000 different things. Its portfolio, it could do 1,000 different things with that information. That's market sensitive information that nobody should have ahead of time. Tim Geithner, of course, denies that he communicated it, and so you have the factual disagreement there. I think what it goes to is the question whether Tim Geithner's relationship with the banks was closer than it should have been in terms of information flow. And I've long felt that, Tim, again, will never challenge his integrity, his desire to do what he believed to be right. But I always thought he was too willing to accept the bank's arguments with respect to both the structure of the banking system and also what led to the crisis of 08. But this issue of whether or not he passed the information is, a factual disagreement that maybe will or will not be resolved down the road.
Yeah, my guess would be not.
Just
based upon what we've seen. President Obama announced, today, that he's planning to nominate Mary Jo White. She was a former U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of Manhattan, which dealt a lot with Wall Street, to be the head of the SEC. Give me your sense of that appointment, if it turns out to be the case.
Good choice. Mary Jo is smart, tough, knows the law, has run the U.S. Attorney's Office in the Southern District during one of its great periods of time. She's now a senior partner at Debevoise & Plimpton, which is a big law firm here in the city. People will say, hasn't she represented some of the major institutions over the past couple of years? The answer is yes. But let me tell you, when it comes to Mary Jo, she is tough as nails, will do what is right, and I feel good about her moving into that position. Now, maybe too late to resuscitate the types of cases that we would have wanted to see brought after 2008, but having said that, Mary Jo is as good an appointment as you can get to head the SEC. I'm very, very happy about that appointment.
What do you read into that? I mean, do you think to a certain extent there is a there's a slight sort of change in perspective in the Obama administration, or is this like you say, a little bit too little, too late to really deal with the real source of the problem, but this is sort of, I don't know, putting a Band-Aid on the wound a little bit late.
Well, I want to be a little kinder to them than to say Band-Aid on a wound. It may be a tourniquet, but it may be that the body's already beyond being resuscitated in terms of the cases that relate to 08. But, you know, I think they had a choice whether they were going to put somebody who was from Wall Street. There were some names floated, good people, but they were from Wall Street. And they would have perhaps brought a greater in-depth knowledge of how, you know, some of those acronym-type investments functioned on the street and might have helped in terms of drafting the regs the SEC has to push out the door. On the other hand, they went for a prosecutor. And I think that speaks to their desire and the public's desire to see cases brought. And I think that's good. So I think it is a slight shift away from pure regulator to prosecutor as the model. Mary Jo can be both and will be both, but I think it speaks well to their desire to move the needle in the right direction.
All right. So contemplating that sort of that mitigation on some level, at least in terms of where they could have gone. I mean, do you think that there is a? What's really sort of troublesome in many respects to seeing something like that film again has sort of opened up old wounds for me, and maybe not that old, but
right.
Is this there seems to have been just sort of a massive failure of, you know, I look to books like Chris Hayes's Twilight of the Elites and sort of that expanding the nature of this conversation on some level, that mm-hmm. there is a fundamental failure by our elites, whether they're financial elites or governmental elites, to just curb the excesses and to deal with, you know, the issues of accountability. Because to the extent that we saw, I mean, if you track from where you go from the savings and loans through the 87 problems we had with mortgages as well. You start to see a lack of accountability and a slow sort of degradation of the ethics and norms that are supposed to sort of guide these things.
Yep. Well, look, I think that is the history of the past 20 years, and it is problematic. It is corrosive, and it has touched many of our institutions, public and private. It is something that we have to try to push back against, and it speaks to a deeper issue way beyond Wall Street. But I think that's why the issue is one we have to think about at a deeper level as well.
I mean, what do you think? I mean, what can stem this tide in some respects?
I wish I had an easy answer. I think that to keep it to Wall Street for a minute, I think that prosecutions and civil cases, both civil and criminal cases, that actually restore some sense that accountability is part of our social infrastructure would help. And that is what we should aspire to. And it's painful at times, but it is important.
Is there any type of, like, I mean, when you start to see these sort of these specific civil actions that are being taken by these clients relative to the banks
supposed fraud or malfeasance in repackaging stuff they knew was crappy, and not just selling it, but also betting it against it. Is there any? I mean, what the one thing that cannot be addressed in those type of actions is the broader implications of what happened. In other words, right. Certain clients may be able to be made whole or partially whole, but society as at large, those people who lost their jobs, those people who lost their pensions, those people whose the cities that went that had to make budget cuts, all as a result of this, there doesn't seem to be a remedy there.
Well, that's why justice needs to be more creative. I mean, you want to compensate those who are direct victims through financial compensation, restitution. But what is more important is saying we will put in place a structural reform so this won't happen again. That still doesn't give somebody back a job that was lost. But at least it says prospectively, we're not going to let you do this again because we're going to take the business model that led to it and change it. We're going to do something beyond simply say you made $5 billion in profits, we're going to fine you $1 billion, and you think, oh, that's not bad, I'm still coming out ahead, which is too often what happens
right.
when you look at the broader business structure and the fines in the context of how much money they're making. So what you have to do is use remedies that are more creative to stop the sort of behavior from occurring once again, once things revert to the norm.
Well, I don't know any sense of where that may come from. I mean, we've talked in the past about the state AGs. They seem to Eric Schneiderman was part of this, round two of a financial fraud commission, which seems to have been just almost in some respects melted away. I mean, maybe you know more than I do in that respect, but what?
Well, look, they've made some cases. I think we have to wait and see. Hopefully there'll be more.
Yes. Well, all right. I hope there will be, and I'd love to talk to you again when those happen. But I appreciate your talking to us today. Elliot Spitzer, thanks.
Sam, it's always a pleasure to be on the show with you. Thank you for inviting me.
Thanks again. All right, folks, that was my interview from this morning with Elliot Spitzer on the, everything emanating out of that film, The Untouchables. I can't highly recommend it enough. I mean, I can try. I highly recommend it, but I can't do it enough. All right, folks, just a programming note. There'll be no live show tomorrow. We will be pre-taping it. I will be having my weekly discussion with Cliff Schechter later today. We will also have film recommendations for you. Sadly, members, you will be stuck. We will have a abbreviated show tomorrow. But fear not, in the coming days and weeks and months, God forbid years, I will be providing you with more and more material for which you to chew on. In the meantime, you can ensure that, can you sense that I'm like exhausted? Well, we are now, let's see, 5-6 weeks out from the arrival of number two. For those of you who have experienced pregnancy before, either firsthand or secondhand, because your spouse is pregnant or your significant other, you can only imagine what the home front is like right now, 2 months out from pregnancy. Things get a little crazy. I'm letting you in on a little secret here, because you never hear this. You never hear this. As a husband or a significant other, partner of someone who is pregnant, until you announce to someone who has gone through it before that your significant other or your spouse is pregnant. They never tell you this. They don't say anything like, did you know that you don't get any sleep for the first 3 years that your child is alive? You do the moment you tell someone who is a parent that your significant other is pregnant. Did you know that after you have one child, that your second child by people who have two children? Well, this has been quoted to me multiple times since I told friends that we're having a second child. they say to me, do you know what a parent of two children call having one child? A vacation. And then I'm not aware of it, but I know that there's a saying that if you have three children, that a parent who has three children just laughs at that and says, wait till you have three children. Having two children is like having no children. So for those of you out there, I've broken the cone of silence.
My family did pretty good with three children. It's when my mom had the fourth, we all fell apart.
I don't even know what the heck. I can't even imagine. You have four children?
Well, including me, yes.
Oh, all right. Wow. That's nuts. I don't know. It's impossible for me to even contemplate. Impossible. All right, folks, we're going to take a break, head into the better half of the program. You can support this program by becoming a member. And we need new members because people drop out. People can't afford it. People move to, I guess, foreign countries, apparently. Apparently, if you move to the northern European countries, you don't want to listen to the show anymore. That's what I've been told. And I got an email to that effect. Fine. But we need new members to continue being able to do this program and bring you and improve, frankly. So if you can become a member, please do so at majority.fm. Become a member. It's majority.fm/become a member. You can just find the link up on the top of the page. Of course, other ways of supporting this program. If you cannot afford to become a member or are just one of those people who are just like, why should I pay for something? Even if I get that extra 50 minutes, why should I pay for it when I get it for free? Takers. I should get Paul Ryan to do one of those like ads for the Majority Report.
Hey, this is Congressman Paul Ryan. The majority, I can't do his voice.
No, you can't.
No, it was terrible.
No,
I
and
apologize.
I think we can all imagine what he would say.
I
maybe
apologize.
Get Mitt Romney to talk about don't be part of the 47%, or it's really actually closer to probably like don't be part of like the 97% of you who do not. You can also support the show by giving us a good review on iTunes, buying your Amazon junk through our Amazon link found at themajority.fm/support-the-show. Buying your coffee from justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, coffee, tea, chocolate. 10% discount code, majority. See you on the better half. You can be part of this program. You can IM me at Majority FM. You can call me at 646-257-3920. For those of you watching live on YouTube, we'll be back in about 60 seconds. And see you then.
Immense. Wrong song.
Oh, yeah. Turn off the